Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half hour featuring unique personalities whose ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers Newark. And now, Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Dr. Dean Marchbine treats patients victimized by natural disasters in countries like Haiti. She's responded to the sick and injured in the war-ravaged areas of South Sudan, Syria, and Libya. But she is just one of the thousands of doctors and nurses who often risk their lives on humanitarian missions all over the world as members of Doctors Without Borders, a nonprofit, non-political organization which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1999. Dr. Marchbine, an anesthesiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, also connected to the Cambridge Health Alliance, is president of Doctors Without Borders. Dr. Marchbine, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What is happening on the ground in places like Haiti and South Sudan and Libya? There are names in the news, but what about the people there? What's going on? Maybe you could give us an idea of what is going on in these various hotspots.
Each of those places is a little bit different. In Haiti, we've been in Haiti. We were in Haiti for 20 years before the earthquake and then the cholera epidemic, and we will be in Haiti. We are planning to be in Haiti for the next 20 years, and in fact, we are probably going to be building a long-term hospital in Haiti. The needs in Haiti are huge. They still have an infrastructure problem. There are the people who were badly injured during the earthquake. Many families were touched by the cholera epidemic and the number of deaths. The Haitian people are these amazing, resilient people. But they've just had so much to bear. I was talking to a nurse today in the office who is going to be going as the medical coordinator to Haiti for the next year. Our challenge as an organization is putting people in the field for long periods of time. One of the challenges of having international staff is that they go, they come, and really what's best for operationally for any given context is to have people there for a long time who put down roots, who understand the community, who are able to adapt.
Who can speak French.
Who can speak French. Actually, yes, absolutely. In South Sudan, we have four projects in refugee camps. We have been calling on other international actors to help with water supply, clean water supply and latrines. We also have our ongoing projects in South Sudan. So I was in a wheel.
Do people really know what is going on there? I mean, I see stories from time to time, but I don't really get a sense of the suffering of the people, to be very honest.
I think that's probably true. It's a difficult place to get access to. Right now it's the rainy season, so there are no roads, so it's hard to get, it's actually physically hard to get interested news media there because it's so inaccessible. We have about 1,000 people a week arriving at refugee camps. And many of these people arrive with the clothes on their back. They are malnourished. They are sick. Their children are sick. Old people. So people are used to bringing young children in for care, but there are also these old people who don't necessarily get served by the camps, and reaching out to them has been a priority and an issue. There are also the mental health needs of a community that's traumatized. They're displaced. They've been at war. They've been, in many cases, chased from their homes. And they're in a very, very precarious physical and emotional state.
In those war zones, there's a lot of danger for the doctors, nurses, and support staff that are stationed there.
I think that the organization, as an organization, takes great effort to mitigate the risk of the places that we go. So my job as a doctor is to be a doctor. But there is the person who is my boss in the field, who is called the field coordinator. That person's job is to network and liaise with local people on all sides of a dispute so that they know why we're there. They've bought in. They've agreed to let us be there and to, in many ways, mitigate the risks.
Dr. Machbain, weren't you in a delicate situation in Libya where you had to treat prisoners who had been part of the Gaddafi regime?
That was a really interesting and wonderful experience. The Doctors Without Borders went to Libya shortly after the Arab Spring began in Libya in February of 2011. And we had tried, one of our basic premises is that we do not take sides. We want to treat those who are injured on all sides of a dispute. But we had been unable to get the government, the Gaddafi side, to give us access. So our access initially was through medical colleagues and contacts in Egypt and then with the rebel side. So by the nature of where we were positioned, we were basically treating the rebels for many, many months. And this was actually
the rebels in an area that was controlled by the government?
No, the rebels in an area that was controlled by the rebels.
By the rebels.
Although I have to say that the teams between April and July did experience shelling, but fortunately they were safe. I arrived after the perimeter was well secured, and as a result of my colleagues having been very insistent with their Libyan colleagues that we take care of all sides, this is very important to us, this is part of our identity and who we are, but also building up credibility with them that we were a trustworthy organization because we had stood with them and we had taken care of their sick and their injured. They finally understood in late July that they needed help dealing with the prisoners that they had. And we said, let us help you. This is something that we can do. And about 10 days before I arrived in Libya, we got access to two military and one civilian prisons. And so I was the prison doctor, and basically I was taking care of the so-called Gaddafi loyalists. And I have to use the term so-called because, for instance, one of the men that I took care of was an engineer. And imagine you're in the United States, you have a government job, you work for the Corps of Engineers, and all of a sudden there is an uprising, and the government, the stable government that you worked for, is now in a state of war with its people. And you're considered, by virtue of having been an engineer in that government, part of the opposition.
And you had to convince them, though, didn't you?
My colleagues before me did a very good job of
doing
that.
Didn't you have any mom who was not quite ready to accept you, but this something did happen that made him accept you? I'm trying to remember that if you had anybody that people coming in and all of a sudden they had a certain kind of illness, did you have to attend to them in a certain way so that they would believe that you were not on any different side or that you were taking sides?
No, I think that our action and our behavior over the preceding 6 months spoke for itself. That we really, the thing that keeps, in my mind, the thing that keeps us safest is that we say what we are going to do, we do what we say we're going to do, and we don't do other things. We're very, very transparent. And I think it was that experience of that transparency that gave us the credibility to do what we did. In fact, the imam who ran at least one of the prisons was just a lovely, lovely man who basically said, I didn't pick up arms to fight for my country. This is what I can do. These are my countrymen, and I need to find a place to bring us all together again. So my first experience in that prison was walking in, seeing the imam holding the hand of this emaciated, very ill man who needed to go to a hospital. He needed to leave the prison and go to the hospital. And the imam was trying to convince him that he would be safe leaving the prison to go to the hospital. And I thought, I'm Alice, and I just slipped through the rabbit hole. This really can't be. But that's who Hisham was. He was amazing.
What happened?
So he convinced the man to go to the hospital. We did the thoracotomy, the chest surgery that he needed to have done. I actually had to physically accompany him from the prison to the hospital and then back again so that there was no issue of kidnapping or any armed intervention en route. But he came back. He was healing. He was doing well. And when I left, he went from being this terrified man huddling in his bed to sitting up, trying to walk and smiling. It was really quite rewarding.
Was he afraid of you?
No, I don't think he was afraid of me. He was
afraid of what you represented?
No, he was afraid of leaving the prison. He was afraid of the crowds outside of the prison. I think that the imams trusted us, which meant that the patients trusted us. There were questions. One fellow said to me, "Where do you get the money to do what you do?" And it felt very good to say to him that most of our money, in fact, 89% of the money raised internationally is from individuals. We don't accept money from governments, and particularly not governments that have a dog in the fight. And I just said to him, it comes from people like my mother, my father.
Your husband.
My husband, absolutely, making donations. And he was very impressed. We believe it's the source of our independence, the financial independence.
I want to interrupt you for 1 second. You said he was worried about the people outside. Who were the people outside?
The people outside were the rebels who now controlled that town.
And he was from the Gaddafi government.
Exactly.
And they didn't do anything to him?
No, they didn't. They didn't. At that point in the Libyan history, I was very, very optimistic that they were going to be able to work this out, because there were very calm heads and a great deal of goodwill.
Let me tell everybody that they're listening to Conversations with Alan Walper on WBGO 88.3. And my guest this time is Dean Marchbein, the president of Doctors Without Borders, a non-political, I want to emphasize that, humanitarian organization of doctors and nurses and lots of other people from lots of other professions who treat victims of natural disasters and wars. But, yeah, I kind of think that when you come back from one of these hot spots, by then your husband is having a nervous breakdown in Lexington, Massachusetts.
So his music store keeps him pretty busy. But in response to a question that you asked me before this interview about my husband, how my husband feels about it, I decided that after 5 or 6 years of doing this, it was time for me to risk hearing what he actually had to say.
What he said?
And ask, I don't have a problem with it, to quote him. I said, "Are you worried?" He said, "Most of the time, not." Which means that he has the same confidence in the organization that I do.
But he puts out a newsletter for everybody to make sure that Dean is okay.
I keep a journal while I'm away, and it allows me to...
What's in the journal?
The journal is about the work that I'm doing, and it's very nitty-gritty. I deliberately don't post it online because I don't want to put the team at risk. I don't want to have to censor myself. It goes out to friends, relatives, their friends. But the interesting thing was, when I was in Lebanon, we were...
That was last winter.
That was this past winter. At the time, we were not able to get a team into Syria. So what we were doing was we were supplying medicines and necessary materials for doctors in Syria. And my job was to both make sure that the materials that we were sending were appropriate and what they needed.
How'd you get it in there?
Well, you know, those supply routes and smuggling routes have existed for hundreds of years. So they just switched from flat screen TVs to journalists and medicines.
Smuggling in medicine to some of the
people? I wasn't physically doing that, but indeed, now we have feet on the ground. And that was actually pretty interesting. So the point of my telling you that was, we were pretty sure that the apartment was bugged and that my email was bugged. So I would Skype the journal to my husband, and then he would email it out from the U.S. It took transparency to a new high, since we knew that our apartment was bugged and that everything
Who bugs
that
you?
We said, We're pretty sure the Syrian government knew about everything that we were doing.
You're minimizing a lot of the things that your organization does, but that people have been kidnapped and some have been killed.
That's not to be minimized, really. There are, I have colleagues now who definitely have been kidnapped and who have been killed, but I do not want to convey the impression that every person who goes out on every mission puts their life at risk, because that's frankly not true.
You do go to areas that are not used to seeing actually Americans.
Some places, Americans are not welcome, and so it's important that our human resources come from all over the world. They're not just from the United States. But I want to also say that we go to places in South Africa that are treating HIV patients, in Malawi, where there are not wars going on. I'm an anesthesiologist, so of course, much of what I do is front lines. The other aspect of the work that we do that I think is every bit as important as the work that we do in the field is advocacy.
And what is that? What does that mean?
Advocacy is making sure that people have access to medicines that they need. So, for instance,
because if you use the word advocacy the wrong way, people would think you're advocating a political cause or something.
No, not at all. We advocate access to medicines and medical care for the populations that we serve. So when you have pharmaceuticals that are so expensive that millions of people cannot afford them, we need to advocate so that the prices come down. Places are able to produce generics so that we can provide access to care.
Doctors Without Borders was created in 1971 by French physicians and journalists. What's it like today?
We're not just a French organization. We are an international organization. There are now 5 operational sections, of which the French is one. There's another one in Brussels, in Geneva, in Athens, Barcelona, and in Amsterdam. And there are 19 partner sections that provide human resources and financial resources. So we are definitely an international organization.
I don't doubt that, and I think that most people know that. They look at you and they see something that you're holding. We're holding up to the highest standards, and most reporters respect you and ignore you very often, and they don't even know that you're the kind of things that you're handling, the amputations, the delivering babies in places that babies are not delivered. What kind of people go to these places?
The motivation.
Who are they? What motivates them? What motivates you?
So it's for every MSF person, I think you would have a different story. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, the French acronym. I think
the French acronym. That's why I brought it up.
Okay. So we did start, the organization was started by French doctors and journalists. So we still go by the French trademark name. I think that for as many people there are in the field, there are as many stories about what their motivation is.
Give me one or two.
So
share that with our audience.
So there are people who want adventure. There are people who want to go to places that other people have never been.
And you have access to a lot of these stories because you're president of the organization.
Have access to these stories not because I'm president, but because I've been in the field. So I talk to people in the field. I can only speak for my own motivation. And what drove me to Doctors Without Borders began before I even thought about becoming a doctor. And it informed why I became a doctor. I was studying art history and French in France in 1971, and the war in Biafra was happening, and the French doctors and journalists and Doctors Without Borders were across the headlines. And I looked at that and I thought, that is just the most exciting, romantic, interesting thing I can possibly imagine. Boy, that sounds like something I'd really like to do. At that point, I was really contemplating being an art historian and a lawyer and working as legal counsel for a major museum. That was my ambition until it was no longer my ambition. And I was called back to the United States because my father was in an industrial accident, and he was electrocuted, and it was the first time in my
life. Excuse me?
He was accidentally electrocuted in an industrial accident. So he
did
was.
Did he survive?
He did not. He was in a coma for 4 months. And during that 4 month period, it was the first time in my life I had ever had any contact with doctors because everyone else in my family had always been healthy. I was the first person in my family to go to medical school. And it being in contact with doctors, thinking about Doctors Without Borders, rolling about in my head, and I started thinking, this is something I want to do. So I went to medical school with the idea of thinking that I wanted to do international medicine. But I got married, life took a different course, and I've always kept a kind of a list of things that I wanted to do in my back pocket.
I can't imagine what happens when you come back and all of these people are waiting to see what's happened to Dean this time. What do you tell them?
So most people are really not all that interested.
I don't believe that.
I
interrupted you when you were doing your autobiography,
yeah.
but I'm just curious about that.
I don't think that people, they have this idea. In fact, one person at work says, how was your vacation? I think most people are very absorbed by their own lives and they want to hear a couple of quick things and then they move on. Close friends and family read my journal. They don't have to ask me. They are getting a blow by blow account.
But if there's no media, of course, which is the reason you've come here.
Right.
Then nobody knows what you guys are doing.
Right. And that's
a sad story, isn't
it? That's the sad story of South Sudan right now. So South Sudan is a place that has been at war for the last 25 or 30 years. They have no infrastructure. A year ago.
Why do we care about them?
Why do we care about them? Because they're human beings who need us to care about them, because they live in a part of the world, and we live in a world where people get on planes, they can do things. We don't live in an isolated world. We're part of humanity, and I believe that we have an obligation to share our humanity and help people when we're able to. I happen to have a skill that makes me able to do this.
And most Americans think about South Sudan if they bother to read it, and they think about oil.
Right, and there is oil, and you know, if we want to take advantage of their oil, then we need them to have a stable country with a population that's fed and healthy so that they can extract the oil so that we can have it. Right now, we have a situation with more than 150,000 refugees because although the border was negotiated, well, the border wasn't quite negotiated in the separation between Sudan and South Sudan. And
when South Sudan became a separate state.
When South Sudan became a separate country. A year ago. And so now there are these proxy wars still going on. And as in any war, the people suffer. More than 150,000 people are on the road going to refugee camps. It's the rainy season. So you have on top of a community with not very many roads, not very many resources, not very many hospitals, not very many nurses or doctors. You have food insecurity. You have people who don't have enough to eat. They don't have protection from the elements. It's the rainy season. It's malarial. They are congregating in the waters around the floodplains around the Blue Nile. It's malaria season. At one point in July, there were 5 children under 5 a day dying from malnutrition and associated what we call waterborne illnesses, and that's not having clean water to drink, not having latrines so that the fecal material is separated from the drinking water. It should be an international crisis, and yet we're having trouble getting any traction for it. I find that traction in the media. We're all very focused on our own internal politics, on our own lives, And it's been very, very difficult. So it's been very difficult to get any media attention. And without media attention, frankly, it's hard to get donations.
How do you get people to pay attention to you aside from coming on shows like this?
Darned if I know. So you talk to individuals, I talk to groups, I talk to people at work. People can visit our website, and those people who are motivated to go to www.doctorswithoutborders.org can read all about the places that we go and what we're doing.
All these pictures of, do you have pictures of some of the victims of the conditions over there?
Absolutely. On the website, there are plenty of pictures. And it's when you look at, when I first went to the field, I thought, like many Americans, that there's a difference between those people and me, that they've always been like that. They don't really aspire to anything better because they don't know any better. And I'm here to tell you that that's just not true. Mothers are mothers, children are children. Our world is very small. And even in South Sudan, where there's not great high-speed internet, there's an awareness that there's that their people live differently and that people live better and that they have access to health care and food to eat and safe drinking water. And they want what all people want for their families and their children.
You know, we pay attention to the places like Haiti because it's on the border of the Dominican Republic. And there's a lot of, especially in New York City, there's a tremendous amount of people who are connected to the Dominican Republic and to Haiti. And yet, after that hurricane, that terrible, terrible, terrible time, and I said hurricane, I meant earthquake, there was an enormous outpouring of contributions. And you say, well, what's happening there? And everybody's reading about it, and there's stories and thousands of pictures and everything. All of a sudden, it stops.
So we have an expression. It's called a CNN emergency. And a CNN emergency is an emergency that's big enough to bring all of the news agencies, specifically CNN, to shed their light on it. And
why CNN?
It's just the expression. But it's true that when the news comes and they focus on it, people's attention is concentrated.
Okay,
and
how Americans can you get people are, to, how are, can you get people down to Haiti watching? I mean, the amount of amputations, the children that are going through this kind of hell. How do you get the media to go and pay attention to something that they've paid so much attention to maybe a couple of years ago? How do you get them back?
And I think it's really up to the media, to people like me, to continue to speak out about the things that we see.
Why don't you think we speak out? That's what I want to know. What's wrong with us?
There's nothing wrong with us. Our attention is focused on other things. There's really nothing wrong with us. But what makes me so proud of Doctors Without Borders is that we don't wait for the CNN emergencies. We're there. We were in Haiti for 20 years before the earthquake. We've been in South Sudan for the last 20 years and will continue to be. And it's up to us to convey to you and to your listeners that this is worthy of their interest and worthy of their help.
Are we too parochial here? Is that it?
I think there's nothing wrong with Americans. I think we are incredibly generous. And, you know, the United States provides a huge portion of the private funds that come from individuals to the entire movement. So I think that there is nothing wrong with the generosity of Americans, but we all lead busy lives, and it's hard to get us to focus on an issue that's so, so far away. In South Sudan, these people are remote. They don't look like us. They don't live like us. It's hard to get, harder to make the case.
But they're in the human race, and so they are us.
They are us.
Dr. Machban, the work you and your organization do is quite special.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for spending some time with us. Joanna Walper is a senior producer of our program. Doug Doyle is a news director. Thurston Briscoe is our executive producer. Suze Dyer is our engineer. And by the way, Conversations with Alan Walper is also available online and on iTunes. Tune in next Wednesday for another conversation with me, Alan Walper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Walper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.